We were looking at the chronology of the patriarchal period in our last session. And we had traced down through the data that provides us with information to establish a chronology, and had found that in doing that, there are two variables that affect the date of the patriarchal period. The first one was 1 Kings 6:1, whether you take that 480 years as 480 exact years, or whether you take it as a schematic number in some way, thus the difference between the early and the late date of the Exodus. The second variable was Exodus 12:40, which speaks of Israel being 430 years in Egypt, but there's a textual variant there, and the Septuagint says Israel was 430 years in Canaan and in Egypt. And so then you get the question of which is the best interpretation. Is it that Israel was 430 years in Egypt, or Israel was 215 years in Egypt and 215 years in Canaan prior to going to Egypt? And that was the point we were discussing at the end of the last hour. Boy, I can feel that falling out of it.
You have to divide it 215,
because the way you get that is the 130, the 60, and the 25. The 130 is the age of Jacob before going to Egypt. The 60 is 60 years of Isaac before Esau and Jacob were born, and the 25 is the 25 years Abraham was in Canaan before the birth of Isaac. So it's interesting that it does divide exactly in half the 430 if you add those figures up. Now, what we were doing then was looking at evidence for, well, we did look at evidence for the 430 years, Genesis 15 and Acts 7, population increase, those factors. And at the end of the hour, we started on evidence for 215 years, and the primary argument there is Galatians 3:17, which says the law that came 430 years after the promise, and the promise was to Abraham. Now, I mentioned, I think right at the close of the hour, that one way of response to the argument that this establishes the 215-year sojourn in Egypt and 215 years in Canaan is to say that the promise was reconfirmed to Jacob prior to going down into Egypt. And I gave you those references, Genesis 46:3, 35:9. So that's one way to respond to that. But I wanted to mention just one other comment on that, and that is the suggestion of K.A. Kitchen. This is in that same book that I mentioned in the last class hour, Ancient Orient and Old Testament, page 53, Note 97, that's on your bibliography, the bottom of page 12. And Kitchen says there, Paul in Galatians 3:17 is concerned to establish one single point, that the law came long after God's covenant with Abraham. He therefore makes his point not by laboriously calculating the actual interval between these events, but simply and incisively by citing the one well-known figure, the 430 years included within that interval. So you see what he's saying is, when you read Galatians 3:17, where it says, "This I say, the covenant that was confirmed before by God in Christ, the law, which was 430 years after, cannot annul, that it should make the promise of no effect." He's saying the 430 years there is really, the law was at least 430 years after. That was the one well-known block of time that everybody knew about in that larger interval. So that's Kitchen's way of interpreting the appearance of that number. It's not that it's to be concluded that the entire span of time from Abraham to Moses was 430 years. Now, he goes on and he makes another statement in connection with his view that I think is important in connection with his view, because he says that Paul made use of the Septuagint interpretation of the 430 years is a gratuitous and unnecessary assumption, where the wish of the modern commentator is perhaps too often father to the thought. In other words, Kitchen is not saying that Paul is following the Septuagint here. He's saying what he is citing is simply the one well-known period of time within the larger interval, the 430 years. That's also a possible explanation. And I think his caution there about saying Paul was following the Septuagint is important, because if Paul was following the Septuagint, and the Septuagint does say there was only 215 years in Egypt, then what do you do about all these Genesis passages? 400 years, which seem quite clear. All right, so Galatians 3:17 is, of course, the strong text in favor of the 215-year view. The Samaritan Pentateuch, as well as the Septuagint, support that view. I've already discussed the reading of the Septuagint, which says the sojourning of the children of Israel while they sojourned in the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan was 430 years. The other line of argument that's used to support the shorter period is Genesis 15:16 and Exodus 6:16-20. Now, we've already looked at Genesis 15:16. You see, Genesis 15:16 says, in the fourth generation they shall come here again. Fourth generation. And Exodus 6:16-20 says, these are the sons of Levi according to their generations, Gershon and Kohath and Merari. And the years of the life of Levi were 137 years. The sons of Gershon, Libni, Shimei, according to their families, the sons of Kohath, Amram, Izhar, Hebron, Uziel, and then the sons of Merari, Mahli, and Mushi. These are the families of Levi according to their generations. And Amram took Jochebed, his father's sister, in marriage. She bore him Aaron and Moses. Now, that's a genealogy. If you trace it out, you find that the structure is this. You move in verse 16 from Levi back to Kohath, and from Kohath to Amram, and from Amram to Moses. Of course, you have Levi has Gershon, Kohath, and Merari as sons. Gershon has these as sons, and Merari has Mahli and Mushi as sons. Amram has Izhar, Hebron, Uziel, and so forth. Those are the other names that are in that sequence in Exodus 6:16-20. Now, the question is, if you link Genesis 15, says four generations, with the Exodus 6, and you say there are four generations, Levi, Kohath, Amram, Moses, that would seem to fit more with 215 years than 400 years. Generation is not normally 100 years. But you see, the problem with this view, there are a number of problems with it. One of the problems is also in Genesis 15, it doesn't only say four generations, it says 400 years. So that door there, or generation, could well be, the way I explained before, a period of about 100 years. So it would be about 400 years. Now, Kitchen also discusses this matter. And he says of the statement in verse 20 that Amram took Jochebed, his father's sister, in marriage, and she bore him Aaron and Moses. He says the statement that Jochebed bore to Amram Aaron and Moses in Exodus 6:20 does not prove immediate descent. We're back in that same issue of language that's used in biblical genealogies. And his view is Exodus 6:16-20 is not a full genealogy, but only gives the tribe, Levi, the clan, Kohath, and the family group, Amram by Jochebed, to which Moses and Aaron belonged. So that Amram and Jochebed are not to be understood as the actual parents. It is the family group, Amram, Jochebed, out of which Moses comes. Now, if that's the case, and I think Kitchen is on pretty solid ground when he suggests that, if that's the case, we don't know who the names of the immediate parents of Moses were. They're not mentioned in the Exodus narrative. It's earlier in the Exodus narrative where, you know, Moses is hitting the bulrushes and so forth. The names aren't given there. Now, there's another factor that I think pretty well confirms that this is a proper understanding. And that is that the Amramites, that is, this group, descendants of Amram, are already quite numerous at the time of the Exodus. Look at Numbers 3, 27 and 28. And of Kohath, see, here's Kohath, the clan, was the family of the Amramites. And the family of the Israelites, the family of the Hebronites, the family of the Uzalites. See, that's all these other descendants out of Amram and Jochebed. These are the families of the Kohathites, go back to the clan. In the number of all the males from a month old and upward, there were 8,600 keeping charge of the sanctuary. 8,600 at the time of the Exodus. So I think you're talking more than one generation. You have to be. Although at the same time, I want to say there are problems with these census figures, and I want to discuss that whole issue later. But it seems to me you can't simply say Genesis 15, 16 says four generations. Exodus 6 goes Levi, Kohath, Amram, Moses. Therefore, that fits better. That's four generations. That fits better with 215. Use that as an argument to establish the 215. It's more complex than that. So I think all things considered, we're better to stick with the Masoretic text with the 430 years. We're better to understand the Galatians passage, either in the way Kitchen does, as citing the one main figure within the larger span, or as indicating the promise to Abraham as reconfirmed to Jacob. The law was 430 years old. Questions, comments? This has, you know, this is not a simple problem. There are a lot of angles to the thing. Yeah.
You seem to have presented the arguments for the 215 and then countered it with arguments from the 430.
Right.
But are there any arguments for the 430?
Well, I think the arguments for the 430 are mainly Genesis 15, 13, 15, 16, Acts 7, 6, and 7, and population increase. Okay? Because you have that 400 years in Genesis 15, the four generations, 100 years each. Abram was 100 years. Quoted in Acts, again, is 400 years. Okay. Okay, let's... I don't seem to have my outline, but we were looking under the difficulties. What appears on the outline here? So I get us reoriented here. The biblical data, the difficulties. Okay, two was the difficulties. Okay. The difficulties, first I said it's difficult to specify this 1 Kings 6:1, 480-year thing. Secondly, the 430-year thing, which is what we've just been discussing. Thirdly, which would really be a C under 2. We don't have any evidence to identify any of the contemporaries of Abraham mentioned in Genesis. We don't have any extra-biblical evidence. to identify any of the contemporaries of Abraham who were mentioned in Genesis. Now, what comes into view there, and we'll discuss this a bit more later, is chapter 14 in particular. Because in 14, you have that coalition of kings that comes and attacks and captures Lot, and Abraham pursues him. And there are a number of kings of a number of countries mentioned in Genesis 14. If we knew from extra-biblical evidence that, oh, here's so-and-so, and we could date him from, say, Mesopotamian records or something like that, it would help to give a link to the time of Abraham. We don't have anything like that. Now, Kitchen says, in a general way, that Genesis 14, with that coalition of kings, fits the political patterns in Mesopotamia for the period 2000 to 1750, but not before or after. It fits the political patterns in Mesopotamia with alliances of small city-state kings for the period 2000 to 1750, but not before or after. So that, to that degree, you can say Abraham fits approximately 2000 to 1750, but you can't nail it down. So the point is, the difficulties with the chronology is these two factors, plus no extra biblical evidence that really helps us much. All right, three is summary. That's on your outline sheet. Here are the variables. We've already discussed this, but just by way of review. The variables are two. Early date for the Exodus or late date for the Exodus? If you have an early date for the Exodus, that's 1446. If you take a late date for the Exodus, that's 1290. And the other variable is whether you follow the Masoretic text or the Septuagint on the length of Israel in Canaan and Egypt. If you follow the Masoretic text, that means that 1446 is plus 645 years. It's the 430 plus 215. So you simply add 645 and get 2091 for the entrance of Abraham into Canaan. If you follow Septuagint, you get 1876. So that's plus just 430. 215 in Egypt, 215 in Canaan. But then if you start from the late date for the Exodus, usually put it about 1290, sometimes as late as 1260, but somewhere in that period, you follow the Masoretic text tradition, plus 645 gives you 1935, plus Septuagint gives you 1720. Now you see what the range then ultimately becomes is from 2091 down to 1720, depending on which of the variables you follow. And that's why Schultz says, at the beginning of his discussion of chronology of the patriarchs, that the thing is not 100% certain, although he favors now the earlier date, which I would favor too. It seems to me that the weight of evidence goes to the early date for the Exodus. I'll discuss that later, the reasons for it, and for the Masoretic text reading. Questions or comments? Okay, let's move ahead then to D on your outline, which is Abraham. We're discussing the patriarchal period. And under Abraham, number one, Abraham as a historical figure. I'm going to discuss first Abraham as a historical figure and then pick up and discuss Abraham as our spiritual father. But first, just some look at Abraham as a historical figure. And small a is general outline of his geographical movements. If you go back to Genesis 11, 28, you read, Haran died before his father Terah in the land of his nativity in Ur of the Chaldeans. Then in verse 31, Terah took Abraham, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his son's son, Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife. They went forth from Ur of the Chaldeans to go into the land of Canaan. And they came unto Haran and dwelt there. So, he's born in Ur of the Chaldeans. Most students of this section of Genesis understand Ur of the Chaldeans to be Ur in southern Mesopotamia. Ur that was excavated by Leon Woolley. You read about that in Finnegan. The third dynasty of Ur dates 2070 to 1960. So you see that's right at about the time of Abraham. The third dynasty of Ur. The third dynasty of Ur was that Neo-Sumerian period that Finnegan discusses, page 49 and following. They went from Ur to Haran. And you read in 1131 that they came unto Haran and dwelt there. Now, Ur is down here. You move up the Euphrates, past Babylon, past Mari, to Haran, way up here in the north. In 12:6, well, in 12:1, the Lord tells Abraham to get out of thy country, from thy kindred, from thy father's house. And you read in 12:4 that Abraham departed out of Haran. And then in 12:6, Abram passed through the land unto the place of Shechem, under the oak of Moreh, and the Canaanite was then in the land. So he moves from Haran down past Damascus and the area of Shechem in Genesis 12, verse 6. In 12:8, it says he removed from there unto a mountain on the east of Bethel. Go down here. See, Bethel and Ai are a bit south of Shechem. Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And there he built an altar. And verse 9 says he journeyed, joined still toward the Negev, that is further south. And then you read in verse 10, there was a famine in the land. Abram went down into Egypt and sojourned there. So he goes all the way down into Egypt. And then in 13:1, Abram went up out of Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, Lot with him, into the Negev. Verse 3 says, he went on his journeys from the Negev to Bethel, unto the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Ai. And then verse 18 says, Abraham removed his tent and came and dwelt by the oaks of Mamre, which is in Hebron. And he built there an altar unto the Lord. So, basically, you have his movement from Ur of the Chaldees up to Haran, down to Egypt, back up into Canaan, with a number of sites in Canaan mentioned, Shechem, Ai, Bethel, Hebron, Mamre. Now that's quite a journey. That'd be a journey today, even with modern means of transportation. So Abraham was someone who traveled a lot. B on your sheet under Abraham as a historical figure is Genesis 14. I already made reference to that. It's a rather remarkable chapter. First thing that we notice about it that's unusual is that it's the only record of a military activity on the part of the patriarch. Even though Abraham, you might think, was somewhat of a nomad, he moves from Ur of the Chaldees up to Haran, down to Egypt and back, we shouldn't view him as a poor person, someone who was just on his donkey and going along the trails. Because he's a very rich man. That's indicated in chapter 13, verse 2, where it says, Abraham was very rich in cattle, in silver, and in gold. And down in verse 6, when you get to that dispute between Abraham and Lot, we read the land was not able to bear them that they might dwell together, for their substance was great so that they could not dwell together. He apparently had enormous holdings and flocks and herds, and he was a wealthy man, probably a wealthy businessman in cattle. He had numerous servants. You read in chapter 12, verse 5, Abram took Sarai his wife and Lot his brother's son and all their substance that they had gathered and the souls that they had gotten in Haran. And they went forth to go into the land of Canaan. The souls they had gotten in Haran, undoubtedly servants. Apparently had numerous servants. And you read in 13:7 that there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's cattle and the herdsmen of Lot's cattle. So Abram and Lot had servants. Many of them served as shepherds, undoubtedly. But those people could act in a military way if necessary. And that's what happens when they are attacked by this coalition of kings and Lot is taken or is kidnapped. You read in verse 14 of chapter 14, when Abraham heard that his brother was taken captive, he armed his trained servants, born in his own house, 318, and pursued them to Dan. They have a number given there of 318 servants that were trained, apparently trained to fight, and they went out to rescue Lot. So you see Abraham from a different perspective than we normally think of him in chapter 14. Second thing about 14 that's quite remarkable and different is that it gives us the names of many kings and the places they ruled, and the names of the places of a number of battles. See, you begin the chapter with the statement, it came to pass in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elasar, and Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, Tidal, king of the nations, that these made war with Bera, king of Sodom, Birsha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, Shemeber, king of Zobeim, and the king of Bela, which is Zoar. All these were joined together in the vale of Siddim, which is in the Salt Sea. 12 years they served Chedorlaomer, in the 13th year they rebelled, in the 14th year king Chedorlaomer, and so forth. It's always been interest to historians. Who were these people? There's been a lot of discussion about the first man there, Amraphel, king of Shinar. And it used to be that many tried to identify him with Hammurabi. There's some slight resemblance between, if you think of the name Hammurabi and Amraphel. Shinar seems to be Babylon, so it would fit in that respect. But more recent evidence for the dating of Hammurabi makes that, I think, unlikely. Hammurabi is pretty firmly dated now in the late 1700s, well, 1728, by late I mean that end of things, 1728 to 1686, so say approximately 1700. The way in which the dating of that has come about is from those Mari letters that were discovered at Mari, where there was correspondence between Hammurabi and Zimri Lim, the king of Mari, and Hammurabi eventually defeated Zimri Lim. But it used to be thought that Hammurabi was earlier, but now it's pretty well fixed that he's about 1700. And also linguistically, at 1700 would be late for Abraham, you see, unless you're going to take the late date for the Exodus and the Ephraim Spicer's Anchor Bible Commentary on Genesis. That's the first entry on page 13. He discusses Amraphel on page 107. And he says, linguistically, there's no way to relate the names, Amraphel and Hammurabi. Spicer says the final L in Amraphel would have to be an error for a Y, Hammurabi. Final L in the Y. And the initial Aleph, a mistake for Ayin. Amraphel has an Aleph, and Hammurabi, the equivalent of an ayin. Now, Aleph and ayin, to us, don't sound a lot different. but in Semitic languages they are quite different. So what Spicer is pointing out is that linguistically you really can't very well make a case for connecting the two names. But that means we don't know who Amraphel is. We have no extra biblical evidence as to who it was. Again, that doesn't mean that we should be suspicious about the historical credibility of Genesis 14. You know, get back to that whole business of fragmentary nature of archaeological findings. Genesis 14 is an interesting chapter, though, because it has all these names. Maybe someday, you know, like these Ebla finds, maybe somebody will turn up some tablets that have reference to some of these people and places that at the present we don't have anything, we don't know anything about. Yeah.
Are there references to their cities?
In extra-biblical, well, yeah, in the Ebla tablets, one of the initial reports was that there was a reference to five cities that are mentioned in Genesis 14. And not just five cities, but they were in precisely the same order that they were mentioned in Genesis 14. That caused a fellow named David Noel Freeman, he was so struck by that, it caused him to propose that the patriarchal period ought to be pushed back to about 2300, way back earlier, to coincide with the Ebla tablets, which is kind of a radical proposal on the basis of five names being mentioned in the same order in the Ebla tablets. But those texts still haven't been published. Those five names and the order of them was information from a lecture or something, and one of these people that did have information about or access to the tablets gave, and it since has been disputed by one of the other people that has access to the tablets that this fellow really had misread some of the symbols, and that these cities weren't named in that same order, and that I've forgotten which ones they said were correctly read and which weren't. But that whole issue at this point is something that's kind of elusive because you can't get at the material. But apparently, in the Ebla tablets, some of these cities are mentioned, including Sodom. The next name, Chedorlaomer. Question?
Dr. McCready's occupants, he said that Abraham and Abram, their customs
are similar.
Is that
It's circumstantial evidence, in the sense that the kinds of ideas that are reflected in the laws of Hammurabi, in some instances, but more particularly in the Nuzi documents, the tablets from Nuzi, with slave adoption, marriage rights, inheritance rights, things like that, seem to be very similar to the customs that we find reflected in the patriarchal narratives. But Nuzi is later. Nuzi is 1500.
He says about
Jacob. Yeah. But you see, that's later. But the fact that it's later, it's circumstantial evidence, doesn't prove a lot. But the fact that it's later is not terribly significant, I don't think, because customs like that tend to be traditional things that don't change that much, you know, over a period of 200-300 years. 400-500 years even. All right, Chedorlaomer is the other name here that's often talked about. The interesting thing is, we know that name to really be Elamite. Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, it says. Because we have found similar names in Elamite texts. Not exactly this one. But Kudor, or Kedor, the first part of it, means servant. And Laomer is an Elamite goddess, Legomer. So it's really a servant of this goddess is the meaning of the name. And it fits with what is known about early Elamite text. All right, let's go on to C. B was Genesis 14. C is Abraham and the Philistines. Question.
I just want to discuss about some liberals who think that this is just a legend and that it cannot be true because Abraham could not have attacked an army with 380.
Well, I wasn't planning to discuss that, but you're right. That often is said. I think the thing that goes against that is that in those Amarna letters, which admittedly is sometime later. But those letters from city-state kings to the Egyptian pharaoh. There you have, in some of the Amarna letters, references to troop contingents of very small sizes, which would be very similar to this. So that, you know, like I think I read to you earlier, Dunkel said that it was ridiculous or something to that effect. You can't believe that a world-conquering army of 317 men could defeat this coalition of Mesopotamian kings. But I think what you have to do is put it in the context. These were not empires, like, say, the Egyptian Empire, Mesopotamian empires later of Assyria and Babylon. These were small city-state kings. And they probably came on a marauding kind of trip down through Canaan, attacking other small towns and trying to plunder them. And 318 men in that kind of a context can be quite a force. Yes?
It doesn't really matter, though, does it? I mean, the same people who aren't going to believe that 318 men couldn't be a coalition of armies aren't going to believe Samson wiped out 1,000 Philistines with a
job either. No, you're right. So, but it's still a legitimate question to ask, how's this fit with what we know about military movements of that time? And it's not incongruent with it. It's really the people who are saying that it is incongruent that don't understand the situation of that time with respect to size of military troops.
Yeah. When there are two other men that went along with Moses,
Melchizedek, yeah. Save only that which the young men have eaten, which portion of the men which went with me, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre. Let them take their portion. That's quite possible. Yeah. All right, let's go on to Genesis, or to the question of Abraham and the Philistines, which is Genesis 21. Where you read, thus they made a covenant at Beersheba. Then Abimelech rose up, and Phicol, the chief captain of his host, they returned into the land of the Philistines. And verse 34 says, Abraham sojourned in the Philistines' land many days. So, in this conclusion of chapter 21, where you have a dispute between Abimelech of Gerar and Abraham over the use of a well, you have a reference made to the Philistines. And here, I would say most commentators say you have an anachronism. Now, what's an anachronism? A-N-A-C-H-R-O-N-I-S-M. An anachronism. That is something incongruous in the time in which it is placed. And what is said is, this must be written by somebody later who knew about Philistines when Philistines were a menace in the land of Canaan. But Philistines did not exist in the time of Abraham, so it's anachronistic. And usually the point is made that the Philistines did not arrive in Canaan until about 1200, which would be long after Abraham's time. Their arrival is usually associated with an attack on Egypt by the sea peoples that was repulsed. And usually it's felt the Philistines came from Crete, came down the Mediterranean, attacked Egypt. They were repulsed by the Egyptians, then they went up and settled on the southern coast of the land of Canaan, and became the group of people that we know from the time of David and Saul and so forth. Now, the critics then say this story was written later. Take it for granted that later times the Philistines were always there. I think in the last class hour or the one before, John Bright's book, A History of Israel, the third edition. John Bright says on page 82 of that book, that the reference to the Philistines is an anachronism. And he says, although there were contacts with the Aegean lands throughout this period, the Philistines themselves arrived much later. Now, what do we say about that? No, I guess I don't. Yes, I do. It's the bottom of page 12. There's the entry by Joseph P. Free, Archaeology and Bible History. In Free's book, page 65 and 66, he discusses the problem of the Philistines. Joseph Free is a professor at Wheaton College for years. He did a lot of archaeological work in Palestine. In fact, he personally bought, in days when that could be done, the ground on which the Tell of Dothan was located. So I think he's here, his family or foundation or whatever owns the Dothan Tell, and he excavated there for a long period of time. Wheaton College has a lot of the artifacts from that. But in any case, he wrote this book, which is a good handbook on Bible and archaeology, Joseph P. Free. He says on page 65, some liberals have held that this reference to Abraham's having dealings with the Philistines about 2000 is a mistake, since the Philistines came in at about 1200. Burroughs of Yale says, we have seen that the Philistines came into Palestine at the beginning of the early Iron Age, not far from 1200. It is quite impossible to date Abraham and Isaac as late as this, yet the book of Genesis represents both as having dealings with the Philistines and their king Abimelech. Burroughs says that this may be explained as a convenient and harmless anachronism, and concludes, quote, at any rate, however the mistake may have come about, it's undoubtedly a mistake, end of quote. And Free's comment is, this type of supposed contradiction is often used by liberals to support their statements that the Bible has problems and even direct contradictions in many cases. But Free says, actually, there's no contradiction. The whole argument's based on silence. As yet, there is no conclusive archaeological evidence that's been unearthed showing that there were Philistines in Palestine in 2000 BC. It's entirely possible, however, that they were in Palestine at this early date and that their numbers were increased by other Philistines from the Aegean at about 1200. This last influx is demonstrated by the archaeological discoveries. It is entirely possible that we shall find archaeological evidence of earlier Philistines in Canaan. In any event, so many other confirmations of scripture passages, one thought to be an error, have been found that it is ill-advised to press an argument from silence and to insist that there could have been no Philistines in Palestine in Abraham's time. Now, see, that is an illustration of the very kind of thing we talked about earlier, of concluding that a biblical statement is suspect because it's not confirmed by archaeological evidence. And whether we will ever turn up evidence of Philistines at 2000, in the area of the southern coastal area of Canaan? It's an open question. Maybe we will, maybe we won't. But I think that we need not feel that we have to conclude that the biblical material is suspect simply because we don't have that confirmation. Okay, any questions on that? I might just say, if you go over to Exodus 13:17, and you have the statement there that God led them at the time of the Exodus, not through the way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near, for God said, lest the people repent when they see war and return to Egypt. The implication of Exodus 13:17 is the Philistines were strong in that coastal area at the time of the Exodus. Now, if you hold an early date for the Exodus, which would be around 1400, you're still prior to the time when there's evidence for Philistines being in southern Canaan, which is around 1200. So it's not just the problem with Abraham and Isaac. But I think that our response to that should be archaeological evidence is fragmentary. It doesn't really establish the case. Yes?
My impression is that the Terah wants before God called them from Abram.
Yeah.
But they must have heard about this Canaan territory. So, the scripture doubts that
the foundation. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
after the sheriff called people to the children about hands, and they got to close them. Mm-hmm.
It's possible, yeah.
Is this, if we say roughly 2,000,
yeah.
2,100 at the time, is this a time of like a power vacuum?
Yeah. It seems in the Middle East generally. And that's why Kitchen says from that time down to about 1750, this thing like in Genesis 14 where these small city-state kings fits that period. Yeah. Yes?
Does the archaeologists that they do find that they do? Are they just not finding anything?
Well, apparently in that coastal area where the Philistines were located, they have found evidence of occupation about 1200. They haven't found evidence of occupation earlier than that. See, that could depend a lot on what kind of an occupation it was, what kind of culture they had, how they lived. It'd be a lot of variables. They just haven't found evidence of earlier Philistine settlement there. That's right. And sometimes you don't know where to dig. See, if you have the long term sites that build up these tells, then you know you have a site identification pretty easy. But if you don't have a long term site like that, who knows where they were? Yeah, you know, it could be anywhere. Okay, we'll pick up tomorrow.
Is there a machine?